National responses to European and global issues, the role of gender in international relations, was a symposium organized by the Department of International Relations and the European Commission representation in Malta. The symposium was organized on December 15, 2010 at Aula Magna in Valletta. This symposium will be broadcast in three parts on Campus FM. It will also be streamed on the Campus FM website.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, fellow colleagues and students, your excellencies. I would like to welcome everyone here to our latest departmental symposium on gender and international relations. This is the second conference organized by Dr. Zamut and a follow-up to last January's conference on environment and international relations. The focus of these symposia have been on new issues and new debates in international relations, thus promoting an opening up and the freeing of the discipline, and the shift away from the old realist school approaches to allow a more radical, innovative voice to surface. In this regard, those writing on the role of gender in international relations have transformed the science by giving a visual and vocal presence to numerous groups that have hitherto been conspicuous by their absence. This is reflected in a growing literature on the changing role of men and women in society. In theoretical terms, at least, we have moved a long way from the literature of the medieval period, when the debates were conducted by men. And people like Thomas Aquinas tells us that woman is subject to man on account of the weakness of her nature, and that man is the beginning of woman and her end. Or the Renaissance period, where accusations of witchcraft were levied at innovative and rebellious women in order to maintain social control. It has also been many centuries since women first endeavored to make their voice heard and attempted to challenge the construct of the masculine state and women's traditional role in it. Women then took over the debate, and feminism became an integral part of the liberal movement. Undoubtedly, feminist strands still have much to offer to the present, more neutral gender debate. The emphasis that the early suffragettes laid on equality in the context of political and legal rights ran parallel to and mutually influenced the labor movements and Afro-American demands for greater access to the political and economic markets. The emphasis that women like Eleanor Radbourne made on women's needs that led to the rise of welfare feminism has been extended to cater for other disenfranchised groups that today also seek to access resources within or across states. However, the greatest contributions of these feminists was that the debate, from its inception, had an international character. Neither barriers of class, status, or citizenship were to be recognized in the struggle for the emancipation of women. By doing so, the movement challenged received ideas that created a centrifugal international relations system, coalesced around overlapping cleavages of class, religion, and nation. Instead, gender was to act as a cross-cutting cleavage, overcoming divisions that split the developed and developing world, focused on Cold War politics. Today, the debate is led by both men and women, within the more neutral construct of gender. For post-industrial societies have long recognized the need for an overhaul and reassessment of the roles of both men and women in society, and the debunking of stereotyping that constrains rather than frees individuals within these modalities. This gendering of international relations continues to have much to offer the discipline in the areas of conflict management, security, foreign policy making, and development and human rights, as will be illustrated by the papers delivered and the discussions taking place here today. Before introducing you to our panel, I would like to thank a number of people without whom this conference would not have been possible. Dr. Carmen Zamut, who has worked unstintingly to make it a success. Ms. Valentina Cassar, for her invaluable assistance and advice. And Ms. Lucienne Borge and Ms. Annelise Callea, for their administrative support. Finally, the Department would like to thank Mr. Martin and the EU Commission in Malta for their invaluable support and partnership in this endeavour. And it is now my pleasure to introduce Mr. Martin to you. Mr. Martin is head of the European Commission representation in Malta. He joined the Commission in 1974 and has occupied a wide range of posts, including Commissioner General for the EU at the Expo 98 Lisbon, Deputy Commissioner General for the EU at Hanover Expo 2000, Inspector of Representations, Head of Unit for Single Market Information, Head of Unit for Paris for Fairs and Exhibitions. In 1986, he was responsible for the launch of the European flag and the European hymn by the Commission. He has also extensive experience in energy policy, from nuclear energy to renewables. A graduate of the London School of Economics, he received his industrial training with the General Electric Company in New York and Paris. And I would now like to give the floor to Mr. Martin.
Thank you very much. Your CV that you read about me may probably be longer than my opening remarks. I want to tackle what we have on, the table this morning in a statistical way. I will not go back to Thomas Aquinas or any of the great medieval philosophers. I want to see what our good European institutions are doing in terms of gender at this particular moment. So I will throw out unashamedly some statistics to you, which are some comforting and some a little frightening. This being said, it is a great honor to be talking in this aula today. It's the first time I have actually visited this part of the University of Malta, and I can only say it's with great pleasure that I address the question of gender in international relations. As you know, the European Union stands for gender equality. It stands for equal pay for gender. And we have a campaign moving at the moment on ensuring that the pay of women rises to that of the male. Women are underpaid by some 18% in general across Europe at the moment. That is a fact, and that is to some extent something which is hampering growth. We want more women in the workforce, bringing their talents to the productive process of the European Union. But I said I was going to be a little controversial. We do have facts and figures of who we employ in the European institutions. At the very top of the European Commission, we have a woman who is leading our external service, Baroness Ashton, and from that point of view, I think the Commission can say it is doing its bit for the promotion of the feminine interest and gender role. In the Commission itself, about one-third of our commissioners are feminine. We don't yet have a balance. President Barroso would have liked in this current Commission to have equality or near equality of gender in the Commission, but member states did not come forward with sufficient feminine candidates. That was in the hands of the member states. How is the Commission as an employer doing on the gender balance? And this is where I think the situation is very revealing. If we look at what we call our level one administrators, By that I mean Director Generals and Deputy Director Generals, some 16% of that grade, the top bureaucrats, 16% are women, leaving obviously 84% male. If we go down one little level, level two, directors, and we have a director I'm very pleased to say with us this morning, Joanna Drake. There the Commission is doing a little better. We have 23% female directors and 77% are men. We have to do better, and the Commission is pursuing a policy of, shall we say, favouring women candidates when they are presenting themselves. We want to get to a gender balance as soon as possible. that is a commitment made by the Secretary General and President Barroso. So there are good promotion prospects for women within the Commission. How do we actually compare, because I don't want it to look as if it's the Commission, which is to some extent isolated in this, how do we compare with the Council of the European Union? In the Council of the European Union, 8% of top jobs are with women. That compares, as I said, to 16% in the Commission. In the Parliament, a newer institution in terms of influx of recruitment, 36% of top jobs are with women. So at number one, the Parliament, at number two, the Commission, and at number three, the Council, amongst the big three institutions. Getting back to director level, there again we see the same pattern. 20% of directors in the Council are women, and in the Parliament, 42% of directors are women. So we are trying, in the main institutions, to redress the gender balance. If we turn to the Court of Justice and the Bank, one-fifth of the judges in the court are women, and in the European Central Bank there is not one woman banker that I am aware of. I saw some raised eyebrows there in the front row. Perhaps I have missed an appointment in the last 48 hours, but there is no central banker. And this will obviously have influence on the way the bankers make decisions at a European level, and we look forward, I think, from the Commission point of view, to see the first woman appointed to the European Central Bank. That said, I won't throw any more figures at you, just to stress the point that as a mere male, and the only male on this side of the table, my last two commissioners have been female. I work for Vice President Redding, who is a very tough promoter of gender equality, and previous to that I worked for a commissioner, Wallström, who was equally very, very keen on gender balance. Please accept me as a mere male to try and bring a little bit of balance to the first part of this particular session. Thank you very much.
I would like to introduce, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jill Stern. Dr. Stern is a senior lecturer in international relations theory at the University of Birmingham. She's author of a number of books, including Gender and International Relations. She has published numerous articles in international relations and international political economy journals, including the Review of International Studies. She has been and continues to be involved in consultancy work at the UK FCO on gender mainstreaming in UK foreign policy, and has engaged in consultancy work for NGOs contributing to expert reports in preparation for the Beijing +10 review process. Dr. Stern will be speaking to us about the emergence of gender in international relations.
My name is Dr. Jill Steens. I'm at the University of Birmingham in the UK. I'm an academic, obviously, and I work in the area of gender in international relations. I have two main areas of interest. One is gender in the theorization of international relations, so theoretical debates. The second main area of interest is international political economy. I've just co-edited a special issue of the Review of International Political Economy on the issue of social reproduction and the crisis of social reproduction, for example. So that's, and I also have a little bit of an interest in the women's human rights agenda, but I'm less of a less expertise, more of a just general interest in that field. I'm going to speak for about 25 minutes, half an hour this morning. I have a little bit more time, I understand. So I'm going to speak for about half an hour. My presentation is basically in two parts, which obviously are linked together. Firstly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the emergence of gender within the academic discipline of international relations, and what some of the debates have been about, and how gender and the study of gender in international relations has developed over a period of time. Secondly, I'm going to talk about parallel developments in the actual world of practice, and I'm going to talk there about the emergence of gender issues within the United Nations and how the United Nations has promoted women firstly and then gender issues through both the human rights agenda and through the development agenda. And I will then end with a discussion of mainstreaming. So that's going to be my presentation, but before I begin, I would just like to take a moment to thank the University of Malta, Isabel, William, and most especially Carmen for inviting me here and for your hospitality. It's my first time in Malta. It's a beautiful place, and I'm very pleased to be here. Without further ado. Well, the emergence of gender within international relations, interestingly enough, in the social sciences as a whole, there is the study of gender has been around since at least the 1960s. There has been some interest in gender within sociology, within political science, within psychology, within other branches of the social sciences. It's relatively late coming to the subject of international relations. There really wasn't any kind of discourse or literature on gender in international relations until the late 1980s, which is quite curious in a way, and it's interesting to think about why that might be, although I'm not going to spend a lot of time discussing that at the moment. Professor Cynthia Enloe produced a book in 1987 called Bananas, Beaches and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics. So that was the kind of first book which explicitly spoke to an international relations audience. But the emergence of gender within international relations, I think, should properly be dated from 1989 and the emergence of the so-called fourth debate within international relations, or the post-positivist debate. Now, this was an opening up of a wide-ranging debate about the whole subject matter of international relations. Isabel referred to the discipline becoming more radicalized in recent decades and becoming more interested in different kinds of approaches and methods. And that's essentially what the fourth debate was about. It addressed a whole range of questions, epistemological questions, questions about, you know, what is the nature of knowledge? How can we claim to know things about the world? Ontological questions, what is it that we're studying when we study international relations? Are we simply interested in states? Are we interested in other levels of actors and engagements? Are we interested in social relationships beyond within the nation state? And how do we conceptualise and theorise that realm? And methodological questions, which are to do with the nature of social science. Should we treat this as a social science as an exercise, which is a bit like any branch of the natural sciences? Should we attempt to be very rigorous in our methodology and quantify things and count things and, you know, assess, collect data rigorously and interrogate data rigorously in a scientific method? Or should we accept that, in fact, our knowledge about the world is always driven by our own normative concerns? It's ideological to some extent, and we are necessarily always interpreting the world. So there was a whole set of debates, and the emergence of gender within international relations emerges within these debates. So initially, there was, I'm going to talk about the non-feminist approach to gender in a moment, but initially most of the work on gender in international relations was being done by feminist scholars. And in the first wave of this scholarship, they were engaged in that critique of positivism, rationalism, thinking about international relations only in terms of states, wanting to expand the agenda beyond states to non-governmental organisations, transnational networks, and to look at questions of social relations, so social relations of inequality, to ask questions about broad, not just inequality between states, but inequality among social groups within states, and look at that on both a national, local and transnational level. And also to look at issues of poverty and inequalities of power and so on. But again, not simply concentrating, you know, purely on nation states as actors. There are a number of approaches within to gender within international relations, and I want to just look at three broad approaches now. Firstly, there was initially a kind of liberal empiricist sort of moment, which is, bearing in mind, of course, that gender hadn't really been explored within the discipline of international relations at all. So this initial moment was a moment of empirical investigation, which asked the question, where are the women? And initially in the late 1980s, there was a literature that emerged that tried to locate women within the international realm. So addressing exactly these kinds of questions, where are women within the international political system? Where are women in international organisations and national legislative-making bodies and policy-making bodies? Where are women at the local levels of politics? And it addressed exactly these questions of representation and underrepresentation, and then broadened out that discussion to questions of power. How does power work in the world? Why is power seemingly so masculinized? And why are the realms of politics, at both, particularly at national and international level, so masculinized? Why is there no room for women in these spaces? Why is it they find it so difficult to break into politics and policy making? Secondly, and related to that, identifying issues of gender discrimination. Was there still, even in the sort of late 20th century, did we still encounter significant discrimination in the way that political systems worked, in the way that candidates for political office were selected? Did gender discrimination work through systems of taxation, through legislative network, through legislative processes and so on? And thirdly, the promotion of women's human rights, and I'll just leave it at that at the moment because I'm going to come back to the human rights agenda presently. But this initial kind of liberal moment then is about promoting women especially, and also then thinking about women within the context of unequal gender relations, so promoting gender equality, promoting women, promoting gender equality. There's a second approach to gender within international relations, which I've called the social relations of inequality. Now, this isn't a Marxist approach at all, but it draws intellectually, it draws from some strands of kind of what you might call early Marx historical materialism. But it also draws upon the work of social theorists like Max Weber and others in the critical theory school, the Frankfurt critical theory school. So it's an attempt to look at gender as a social relation of inequality, and how it's embedded both materially but also ideologically, how gender relations of inequality are perpetuated through certain ideas and certain gender ideologies. And this work has tended to be more focused on political economy and the globalisation debate. So these scholars have been interested in looking at global restructuring, market liberalisation, changes in the global economy, how that impacts nationally and locally, and then asking questions again about impacts, who have been the winners and losers, what is the nature of inequality and how is it affected by both global and national and local processes, where are the poor? For example, you know, United Nations statistics and UN development reports consistently record that when we look around the world and we look at the issue of poverty, it's very helpful and important and pertinent to look at this in terms of relationships between countries and states, because there are significant inequalities in between countries and states. But also, if we look at poverty amongst groups, we find that even amongst the poorest, women tend to be the poorest of the poor. So investigating issues of inequality in both global, national and local perspective, issues of poverty, looking at gender and global restructuring. For example, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when gender was emerging within the field, a lot of the kind of discussion then was about what was happening in the global economy in the wake of the various economic crises in the late 1970s and the economic restructuring that had followed that. What had happened to the global workforce as industry or certain sections of manufacturing industry had shifted from the global north to the global south? And you had the emergence of these kind of development zones, export production zones, free trade zones in the global south. What was happening to the gender division of labour? Why was it that in the emerging economies, whose economic growth and dynamism was being driven so much by export-led growth, which was being generated in export production zones and free trade zones, why was it that 70 to 90% of the workforce in those zones was female? What was happening there? Why was that occurring? And also this work on social relations of inequality has looked at social reproduction. So for example, the current economic crisis that we're all experiencing one way or another in the UK, in my country, the coalition government has just engaged in a comprehensive spending review. There is going to be a massive rolling back of public expenditure and a reliance on the so-called big society to provide many services, goods and services and so on. The question then emerges is who actually provides those things? Who provides childcare? Who provides early care education? Who is doing that work? And what happens to that workload when the balance between the private sector and the public sector, state and society, shifts? So it's engaging with those kinds of questions and also looking at the role of various institutions. So what role does the International Labour Organization play in protecting the rights of unprotected workers, which has a gender dimension to it, as well as looking at other institutions like the World Health Organization and development agencies and so on. Now, there is a third approach. I don't have much more to say about the academic subject, I'll be moving on in a moment, but there's a third approach which I just want to mention briefly, and I've intentionally used the same picture here as I used with the liberal slide on human rights, because this is a more kind of critical post-structuralist and post-colonial kind of moment in feminist international relations, which looks at gender less in terms of just looking at women and men and their participation, or looking at questions of gender as a social relationship of inequality, and sees gender as essentially something which is discursively constructed. So it's about the language that we use to describe the world, how we construct our understanding of the world that we live in, and how we relate to others. And this post-structuralism in international relations has really been looking at the way that gender is constructed in various policy texts and policy documents, which is something this audience is particularly interested in, but more generally in cultural and visual texts. So, for example, there is quite a lot of work around at the moment which is looking at the way in which the women's issue of women's human rights has been constructed through media representations in relation to the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's why I chose to look at that picture again. A liberal moment would say, this is women's oppression. A post-structuralist moment would say, this is the way in which women in other parts of the world are being presented to us in order to link a women's human rights agenda to a foreign policy agenda in various ways and to legitimise that practice. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that intervention is going to improve the position of women in other parts of the world. Related to post-structuralism, there is also a post-colonial strand in international relations, which again is more critical, has looked at things like the gender and development agenda, but has asked the question, to what extent has the United Nations and other organisations, other international organisations that have been promoting women's rights, have been promoting gender equality, actually reproduced a significant dimension of North-South power relations by presenting women in the West as more advanced than women in the developing world, presenting gender relations as more equal in the Western world and the Northern Hemisphere than in the Global South and so on, and thereby perpetuating a kind of imperialist understanding of women in the Third World, so-called Third World, or in the developing world. So this is a more critical kind of moment which looks at gender as a construction, looks at the way gender is presented and the kinds of strategies and policies that are thereby legitimated. Finally, alongside the feminist strand of international relations, there has also been a kind of strand of literature which has argued that we should be engaging with gender, but has not necessarily taken on board the feminist agenda, which is seen as being too ideologically driven or too much informed by that kind of normative project of promoting gender equality. And rather, this is a kind of approach to gender in international relations, which seeks to look at gender within the context of more mainstream rationalist or positivist approaches to the subject. So, for example, right back in the early days of the late 1980s, Robert Kahane, who's a very prominent IR theorist in the United States, was writing about gender and saying, we should take gender seriously, but gender is a variable. It's one of many variables that might inform our theories of the world about. It might help us to understand aspects of causality, or it might help us to quantify impacts in international politics. So it's introducing gender as a variable. Adam Jones developed this work by looking at both masculinities and femininities in international relations and looking at how violent conflict and political violence impacted on men, particularly in the Bosnian crisis. So introducing masculinities into the study of gender. Within social constructivism, there is also a strand of thinking which argues that we can study gender, it doesn't have to be feminist, but we can look at again at where the when, where and how gender matters in international relations. And more recently, even within the critical strand and feminist strand of IR theory, there has been a kind of a turn away a little bit from thinking about feminist IR simply in terms of critique, deconstruction, deconstructing power relations, and to actually turn back to, away from theoretical debates, and to turn back to real-world problems. So this has encouraged feminist thinkers, contemporary feminist thinkers, I'm thinking about people like Brooke Ackerley particularly, who now talk about the need to be both critical and problem-solving in the study of international relations. So to look at the way in which critical perspectives and feminist perspectives on international relations can be used to address real-world problems and issues. And hopefully, I'll come back to this, and hopefully you'll see how this links to those real-world questions in a moment. But this is an argument now for both quantitative and qualitative methodologies. We need certain data to understand the way the world works. We also need to be sensitive to the need for qualitative methodologies in order to interpret that world in various ways. So that summary then, feminist IR has critiqued scientific knowledge, it's addressed issues of the public and private. A good example of that, for example, would be issues like violence against women. A couple of decades ago, many people commonly thought that the issue of violence against women was something which was regrettable, but it happened within the context of private familial relations and there wasn't much you can do about it. Now, thanks to the efforts of feminist NGOs, women's movements, transnational activists and state policymakers, activists on the inside as well as the outside political system, the issue of violence against women is now considered to be a human rights issue. So it's gone from being private to international within the context of a couple of decades. Making women and men visible as women and men, as gendered subjects within international relations, the production and reproduction of gender relations of inequality, the production and reproduction of masculinities and femininities in international relations, analysing gender inequalities and how they're embedded in day-to-day practices, elucidating the way masculinities and femininities are forged, shaped and reproduced in relation to global forces, looking at how gender is discursively produced, and finally, more controversially in some respects, empowering women as subjects of knowledge. Now, I just want to talk for the final 10 minutes now on the emergence of gender within international politics. Again, it's a bit of a thumbnail sketch and a potted history, but I think it will help, or maybe it will be a way in which I can draw these things together. If we look at where gender emerges within the actual practice of international politics, it's useful to date this. There is something before the emergence of the United Nations, and we could talk a little bit about the League even, but the establishment of the United Nations is a significant moment because that's actually the first time in international relations that you have an international document, a charter, in which the principle of sexual equality is embedded in that charter. As far as I'm aware, it's the first time you have that moment that sexual equality becomes an international issue. With the setting up of the UN, you had the establishment of the Commission on the Status of Women, and throughout its history, the Commission has worked on a number of areas. In its early life, it was very important in promoting things like equality in nationality laws. Many women found themselves stateless in times of conflict, or if they married out of their national grouping, there were certain issues to do with their citizenship that were problematic. So addressing these issues of nationality laws, marriage, rights in divorce, rights to property, and of course even in post-1945 the right to vote was still an issue in many parts of the world. Okay, I'm going to round up in a moment. As the UN has developed over time, there has tended to be an emphasis more on development issues within international politics, which has been reflected in the United Nations conferences on women and the setting up of special agencies. I'm just going to talk very briefly about the fourth UN conference on women. Because the fourth UN Conference on Women was in 1995 in Beijing, it emerged in the context of a post-Cold War agenda. And it has seen, development issues are still on the agenda at the UN, of course, but it has seen very much the re-emergence of a women's human rights agenda. One of the significant outcomes of the Beijing Conference was the validation of the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. This has a longer history. It's been around since the late 1970s, but significantly a lot of states signed up to it at that time. But also the event was significant in terms of the emergence of gender mainstreaming, which means, and this is very significant for this conference, so I'll just spend a moment on it, gender mainstreaming means now that national governments, governments that sign up to CEDAW, the elimination on the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, are obliged to mainstream gender issues within all aspects of their policy-making process and to implement the standards that they've signed up to. The NGOs have played a crucial role in this, forging enduring networks, lobbying around the CEDAW documents, and also playing an increasing role not only in lobbying and advocacy but also in implementation and monitoring. Okay, I do have a few more slides, but I'm going to stop there because I'm past my time, but we can maybe develop some of these points in questions.
Dr. Joanna Drake, Director, Promotion of SMEs Competitiveness, DG Enterprise and Industry, European Commission. Dr. Drake has occupied the current position since 16th of January 2010. Since October 2005, she was head of the European Commission representation in Malta. During the preceding 5 years, Joanna has been company secretary and head of the legal and regulatory department of Vodafone. Before venturing into telecommunications, Joanna's professional career centered entirely around European Union matters, with an accent on law. After obtaining her postgraduate qualifications in law from the College of Europe in Bruges, where she specialized in EU competition and internal market law, Joanna spent 5 years as senior legal officer at the EU Directorate of Foreign Affairs in Malta. She was closely involved in the pre-accession negotiations between Malta and the European Union. Dr. Joanna Drake will be speaking to us about European initiatives to promote female entrepreneurship.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kaleya, and thank you for this opportunity to be here again in my, well, in a way, alma mater. I used to be a sixth form student in this building, and it brings back really great memories. And I'm even more happy to be back in my country, or as we say in the Commission, the country I know best. But I prefer it to call it my country. What's the link between the title of today's conference and what I'm doing in Brussels, and why am I here to talk about it? Well, I was quite intrigued with the title, which talks about the national responses to European and global issues, and of course the role of gender in that. And I thought it's a very appropriate title, actually, because if there is or has been a European and global issue, I think nobody can deny that the financial economic crisis has been definitely something very global and very European. I mean, until these recent days, we're still hearing about bailouts that are necessary, and also the propping up of national deficits. What I'm doing in Brussels, what is the link? What I'm doing in Brussels is SME policy. And I was particularly keen to come and talk about a perspective of this, a gender perspective of how we are responding to these international crises, like the economic and the financial crisis, from the SME perspective. Why? Because in recent days we launched, interestingly, the second phase of what we are calling the female ambassadors for entrepreneurship, or female entrepreneurship network. Basically, a number of ambassadors that we could have called in inverted commas, who are entrepreneurs in their own right, they're all female, and we launched a second phase of that all across the European Union and also other countries. I will be talking a little bit about that in more detail later. The idea behind this is, number one, we are wanting, in fact, to tackle the biggest crisis, which is that of creating more jobs, and I think that is really the bottom line. And the way to do that, I think, on the ground, being more creating impact, is making sure that those entrepreneurs who have made it, now they could, of course, be male, but given the figures that are still characteristic of female entrepreneurship in the European Union, but I would also dare to say in the world, but of course in the European Union, quite strikingly, they are still quite low. I think we need to consolidate what we have, and we have to, in terms of female entrepreneurship, and believe you me, there's a lot of energy out there, which I think the impact of which is still rather latent, but what we definitely need to do is beyond consolidation, make sure that these female ambassadors are out there inspiring others to create jobs. I just give you one figure. Jobs in the European Union, 3 out of every 4 jobs are created by SMEs. Not all, of course, female entrepreneurs, but they are created by SMEs. The crisis have brought about quite a tumultuous decrease of jobs that were created in the last 5 to 6 years. I would say a third of those jobs created, about 3.9 million out of the 9.1 which were created over 5 years, were chopped off because of the crisis. Our main challenge being, therefore, for SMEs in the SME world is to make sure that SMEs are back on track as being the main job generators in the European Union. And a big chunk of that responsibility, I would say, is to allow women not only to be on the track of entrepreneurship early as possible in life, but also to encourage those who have made it with a lot of determination and relentless courage and energy to go out and inspire others to do the same and better. And I think there is a lot of European added value there, and that is why we are getting involved from where we sit, together with our collaborators at the national levels, to consolidate these networks and to make sure that this message goes across. But that is just to create the link in my mind as to where women could actually be responding to everyday realities on the ground in terms of jobs, in terms of actually addressing, by being women, by being females, and by being very determined and very energetic, to one of the biggest crises, I think, and long-lasting ones that we've had in recent times. So, of course, we know that entrepreneurs are indispensable to the European economy, to the European growth. There's still a lot of scope for prosperity, a lot of scope for employment, as I have just said. And most of this is created by SMEs. The creativity of entrepreneurs and also the potential of women is still a very latent source, as I said in my introduction, for economic growth and also new jobs. And therefore, we really need to strongly encourage that female element in entrepreneurship. Some quite sad figures now, but I think it's important to put things in perspective. Female entrepreneurs constitute only 34.4% of self-employed in the EU25. These are Eurostat figures. And I talk about EU25 because the Eurostat figures are typically rather late, and therefore they still reflect a reality without Bulgaria and Romania. And women are only 20% represented in industry. Their share in startups is also quite low, at 30%. Our determination is that this must change. And we change that by encouraging the creation of more women-led businesses in our societies. This will not only bring fresh business ideas, but it will also empower women economically and create new sources of welfare and jobs. The last Eurobarometer survey by the Commission, published this year, shows that only 39% of women in Europe prefer to be self-employed, compared to 51% of men. Moreover, 2/3 of women admit they have never thought about setting up a business or taking the steps to that end. This percentage is only 57% amongst men. And by the way, to put things in a wider perspective, not only the man-woman dynamic here, we have a problem in the European Union about the number of people who want to become risk takers rather than employed. When you compare the figures between European Union figures, US and China, there's a huge gap between one and the other. We have a huge problem in the EU because only 45% of young people say that they would like to become risk takers, i.e. entrepreneurs. when those figures in America are 55%, that's already a big jump. And of course, if we go to China, we're talking about 79% of young people saying that they want to become entrepreneurs. So there's a real issue about how early in life do we train people's minds, whether they are male or female, it doesn't matter, to actually become risk takers. And I think the problem, of course, with the figures I've just given now is more pronounced in women. So women are more likely than men to opt, however, for self-employment because of the freedom to choose the place and time of work. So, in fact, self-employment is actually quite attractive to women. Why? Because of the flexibility it offers. Or because they have a member of family or a friend who is also self-employed. In fact, there are 33.5% of women to 27.1% of men. In other words, women are naturally quite attracted to become entrepreneurs, but the reality on the ground is, in fact, very different, as I have just said. And therefore, it is clear that in terms of fitting in a mindset, entrepreneurship fits well in a mindset of a woman's disposition. However, women, as usual, face a number of difficulties in establishing and running their businesses. Although most of these difficulties are common to both genders, in order to be fair, in many cases, many of them tend to be more significant and therefore more creating more impact on women. And this is due to factors such as a poor business environment, especially access to finance and also gender stereotyping. The choice of business types and sectors, retail and services are preferred by women. Information gaps, and these are very real, because of lack of female networking in the business world. Lack of contacts and access to networking, gender discrimination and stereotypes, weak and inflexible supply of childcare facilities, difficulties in reconciling business and family obligations, as well as differences in the way women and men approach entrepreneurship. To successfully spur female entrepreneurship, these issues need to be addressed in a coherent manner, both at European and national level. The economic crisis, how has this impacted women? It has had different impacts, in fact, on women and men. Until now, men's employment has been more affected, on average, by their concentration in some hard-hit sectors, such as industry, construction, etc. But caution is needed with the figures. The greater concentration of women in smaller firms, for instance, means that their job losses do not hit the headline so often. There are a lot of small businesses owned by women that work with big industries. A survey by the British government on the impact of the economic crisis on women shows that women are generally more concerned than men about the effects of the downturn on themselves and their families. This concern is heightened amongst parents and carers, as well as amongst women in industries that are generally perceived to be more vulnerable to recession, such as service industries. As we all know, the economic crisis has hit hard small businesses, and active policy intervention from member states plays an important role in bringing about recovery. Moreover, reduced purchasing power is having a greater influence in areas in which women entrepreneurs are active, such as retail sectors and services. When it comes to women entrepreneurs, the specific characteristics could turn to advantages for their businesses during the economic crisis. Why? Firstly, women attach more importance to family circumstances when considering setting up a business, 61% versus 49% in the case of men. They will think very carefully about probabilities of success and examine every potential source of failure in detail before they use the family house as collateral and or family savings as capital to start up their businesses. Secondly, in most cases, when women decide to start up a new company, they keep their former job and carry out both activities in parallel for some time. Well, multitasking, aren't we all familiar with that? In this case, we could say that women are considered to be more cautious than men, and their awareness of risk or failure is more developed. This is also linked to the fact that potential women entrepreneurs often do not have access to information nor to relevant business organizations and networking. Having access to role models and to mentoring schemes can be crucial in encouraging women to go ahead with their business ideas. This would allow them to start up from a feasible and realistic basis and increasing their chances of survival and success. Thirdly, women take over existing businesses after a longer testing period than men, once they are familiar with the company's activities, because of heritage, separation or divorce from a business partner, etc. This means that they have a high potential of being successful in their business. Recent research has shown that in France, 33% of all businesses' successes are women. They take over businesses mainly in the services sector. The fourth particularity in financing is financing. Women's startups use less capital than men's and have less equity. I think the bank should be here to listen to this. They prefer looking for funding through family and friends, but when they get money from banks, the rate of repayment is higher than that for men. As a result, in the economic crisis, women entrepreneurs are considered better clients for the banks than men. Finally, women entrepreneurs have, compared to men, a lower but steadier growth. This often means less risk for failure. Of course, one may understand easily that these characteristics are often linked to the need of better reconciling business and family obligations and to the part-time schemes usually followed when starting up. I know that I have to end in a few minutes, but I do have to say something about what's happening right now. I said something already about female entrepreneurs, what we are doing with the SBA. The SBA is our baby in the SME Directorate in the Commission. It is the SBA is a small business act. It is a set of 10 principles which member states are really encouraged to implement in order to create a more friendly business environment for businesses, for SMEs, and it is at the moment being reviewed. This is what's happening now, and a new communication with new actions and new measures will be coming out at the beginning of February. One of the areas where, of course, we highlighted in the SBA is female entrepreneurship, and the network of female entrepreneurship ambassadors, which I've just spoken about at the beginning, is actually that. It might be interesting for you to know, even if you want to get maybe in touch with some of these people who are now numbering 250 ambassadors in 22 European countries, and I mentioned the countries just for your information: Albania, Belgium, Croatia, Cyprus, Denmark, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Italy, Ireland, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Luxembourg, Malta, Norway, Serbia, Slovakia, Sweden, and the UK. They have become operational at the end of 2009, but it's growing, and as I said, on the 8th of December, just a few days ago, we launched a second phase of that. In fact, some results already from this networking, thanks to the work of these ambassadors, 52 new women-led enterprises have been created, providing at least 68 new jobs. It's very modest, but it is something that comes purely out of networking between female entrepreneurs. A new, interestingly, mentoring scheme for female entrepreneurs will be launched in the coming months as well by my directorate, and this actually provides free mentoring for women who would like to enter into entrepreneurship. And of course, the bids and the calls for proposals will be published shortly. There is also the Commission Promoting Entrepreneurship Amongst Women Graduates, and there we are financing actions to provide courses on business skills for women graduates, and this will help them consider a career as an entrepreneur in their chosen field of interest or study. I have to be self-critical, though. I do not think that at that level, tertiary level, it might be a little bit too late already. I think entrepreneurship is something that needs to be part of the first few years, actually, of schooling, whether it's male or female, it doesn't matter. And I think member states must be recognizing more and more the importance of this as they go along. The other measures include also European Network to Promote Women's Entrepreneurship, which is the WES, W-E-S, and this is composed of government representatives responsible for promoting female entrepreneurship, and it has at the moment 30 members from 30 European countries, and they provide advice, support, information and contacts regarding existing support measures for female entrepreneurs. Legislative action under the SBA also aims to support entrepreneurship for women, you might have heard was one of the main measures taken during the economic crisis was in fact a state aid regulation which was actually exempting state aid of up to 1 million euros for small enterprises newly created by women. So it was a very targeted measure, legislative measure, to exempt governments from any action at Commission level if they gave state aid for enterprises run by women up to 1 million. In conclusion, it is clear that, of course, these are only measures that are perhaps a little bit sporadic, but I think goes to show that we need to do much more. And we need to even create platforms, perhaps, for best sharing between member states as well. We need to have more women entrepreneurs, and that is where the difference is made on the ground and with a lot of impact and a lot of visible impact, which also carries another added bonus, and that is the inspirational pull of that happening on the ground. I'm not saying that women in decision-making positions and women in certain at the top of certain enterprises is not important. Of course, that is also very important. But I think that women on the ground being entrepreneurs and showing the way to others to be creative, to be determined, to have more jobs, I think there's a lot more to be done. And I can only encourage that whatever the Commission is doing and more, I hope that the Commission will be inspired actually by Member States' actions and not the other way around. And that is my best wishes for our best response, one of the best responses that we could give to national and international crises such as the one we have. We will, of course, from our end, continue to address these issues and to carry out specific actions for women entrepreneurs on this basis. And, of course, any good ideas are welcome from your end. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that very thorough paper on the role of women entrepreneurs. I'm sure it will serve as an inspiration for many female students in the audience. And I would like now to introduce Ms. Anna Borge, who is presently working for the Centre of Labour Studies at the University of Malta. She is coordinator of the diploma course in gender and development and lectures in the area of gender and labour market at the same university. She's also one of the key researchers of the centre, which is responsible for research produced for the European Foundation for the Improvement of Living and Working Conditions. Anna is currently pursuing her doctoral studies under the supervision of Professor Susan Lewis at Middlesex University. She currently holds a master's degree in psychology from Manchester Metropolitan University and a diploma in social studies and development from the University of Malta. Ms. Borge is a founding member and current chairperson of the Malta Confederation of Women's Organization and a board member of the European Women's Lobby. Today she will be talking to us about politics and are we in a state of gender blind bliss?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Dr. Kaleya, for the invitation. This morning I will be asking a few questions because I have more questions than answers, really. And the three questions which I will be asking is, men are the norm in politics. That I'm going to make that statement. I hope you will agree with me when we go through the presentation. So where does that leave women? The second point which I want to stress is that negative inaction, not taking action, is not the solution. Finally, I am going to be asking whether the EU can be the solution to increasing the representation of women in politics. So those are the three points I will be discussing in my presentation. And rather than speaking about the sad figures about women in politics, I want to do a little game with you. Spotting the odd one out. It should be fun this morning. And may I remind you, just in case you forget, that women make up 50% of the human population. So, I try to look at a few of recent pictures taken in the last year, 2009-2010, of very important summits across the world. Since we are in international context, this is the G8 summit, which was held in Italy, in L'Aquila, in 2009. And, of course, spotting the odd one out, perhaps is easy in this case, no? Angela Merkel there, right at the center, surrounded by world leaders, obviously all men. If we go a little bit afar, here is the Australia's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, and again, you have the opportunity to spot the odd one out right at the corner, probably right here at the end, you can see a woman politician. This is the meeting of the world leaders in London. Okay. And these are the heads of the European political parties. You know that the EU has various political parties, and this is a little bit harder because actually there is one woman in the Green Party, and she co-chairs the head of the Greens right over there, and the rest, I don't have to stress much about that. Coming closer to home, this is a picture of our parliament, okay? And this is the last picture I want to share with you. What is odd about this picture? Is there anything odd about it? What do you think? A lot of people don't think there is anything odd in the fact that we have six MEPs elected in spite of having very capable candidates in both the last two elections we have. So here is the situation, and I think by now you would all agree that men are the norm and women are not so normal in the world of politics. So just by being a man, just by having, a male persona, not a female persona, in politics, that is the norm. So I have put a plus there because it's something which gives you brownie points. If you are a woman, you are the exception. So obviously, you get a negative mark there just by being a woman. So simply by being a male and not a female, certain opportunities, activities, resources are made more accessible to you than to others. And we can call these privileges, really, because it's a privilege. And since these are a normal part of many people's life experiences, very often it's difficult to see them. Hence, I think we operate in a state of gender blind bliss. Many people, when I showed you the six male MEPs, they just operate in that gender blind bliss, and they say, what's wrong? You know, we're fine. We have six MEPs, they're all male. So what? Nothing is wrong with that. When we are talking about male privilege, I think I can see some of my students here. We discussed this in the unit about masculinity. We are talking about hegemonic masculinity. So here, the fact that men dominate, there seems to be a consensus. You know, it hasn't come around by a revolution or something, but we just accept it and take it as the norm. So there is a consensus about it, and we're not doing anything about it. And as you can see, just by being male or female, the starting point for elections is different. Women start the race, far behind men, just because they are females. Of course, female disadvantage is also invisible. Likewise, many assume that the disadvantage doesn't exist. They tell you, well, we had candidates, for example, in the last MEP elections, that we did put candidates, and they just didn't get elected. So what? I mean, we can't see any disadvantage. What's wrong? What are you talking about? And so, if it does not exist, many think that we do not need to do something about it, and we just leave things as they are. And as soon as we mention things like quotas or positive action or taking temporary special measures, like the United Nations is telling us in the CEDAW report, in order to get more women elected, objections abound. Objections from women, objections from men, from politicians, from female and from male candidates, they abound. And they tell us, no, we're fine. We don't want to do anything about it. We just want to compete on the same lines. And little do they realize that we're not competing on the same level playing field. So here I'm going to argue that negative inaction is not acceptable, you know, like, because if we're saying that positive action is not okay, the opposite of positive action is not neutrality. You know, you can't not do anything about it, because in this case, I call it negative inaction, not taking action when you should be taking action, in fact. And this is means that you accept that men have an advantage, and you just, you know, take it for granted. So in order to challenge and overcome the barriers and the hurdles, you cannot remain neutral, but you have to take some form of action to address the unfairness. And this is the result of the starting point. The fact that the starting point is different, obviously a lot of men have an advantage and get elected. And the strongest argument I can share with you is the fact that the current incumbents, the majority of men, of them are men, okay? And this severely restricts the rate of member turnover at each election. What am I talking about here? Okay, so if men till now dominate in the political sphere, on average, and this is statistics, research statistics, around two-thirds of members who are re-elected on each occasions, they are old faces, people who have been around in previous elections. So when two-thirds of the candidates are re-elected, there is only room for a third new face. So even in the best case scenario, if women take 50% of all seats, not taken by the one-third incumbent, it will obviously take many years to bring about real change. Just to give you an example, on average, if in an election 50% of the candidates were female, this would result in a parliament with just 39% women. Okay? Therefore, we need at least 63% candidates in order to achieve parity with men, because of the incumbents of previously, the fact that they were men. It has taken 70 years for Denmark, Sweden and Finland, Iceland and Norway to exceed the 20% threshold of female candidates, taking the incremental route. Okay? And one can only wonder how many years it will take Malta to do the same. So if men continuously get a head start in the race, what can we do? What is the role of political parties? We know that political parties are the real gatekeepers to public decision-making bodies, especially in the nomination process. That can make a very big difference. But are they going to nominate 63% women in order to get the 50% balance? And I don't think this features very high on their agenda. They have other things. And so I don't think the issue of the woman candidates and women representation in parliament is very high on their agenda. So what should be the role of EU in all this? Can the EU remain complacent in view of this clear advantage of men and the clear disadvantage of women? And I wanted to take a sort of the humorous side to it, because the EU takes action on all sorts of things imaginable. For example, it had an EU directive laying down the standards of cucumbers and how bendy they should be. It also had a directive setting the quality standards of bananas. And currently, there are three separate EU directives on the loudness of lawnmowers. Okay. But what has the response to gender imbalance in politics been? I will leave you to answer. I think it is more like the three monkeys, where we are not seeing anything, we are not doing much about it, and you know, inaction in this case seems to be the order of the day. So I think rather than waiting for national responses, if we bother to make a directive about how bendy the cucumbers can be, I think, we need a European response on the issue of representation of women in decision-making positions. I hope we will not have to start growing moustaches to get elected. This was, in fact, I took it from a campaign organized in the last MEP elections by our Turkish colleagues in the European Women's Lobby, where they actually had the picture of the woman in moustache to show this advantage of being male, you know? And I hope we don't have to become men and grow moustaches to get elected. So back to serious business. I'm going to end on a note with which Edmund Burke, a 19th century philosopher, said. He said, all that is necessary for evil to flourish is for good men, obviously I included, and women, to do nothing. So I took this line of thinking, and I will conclude by saying, all that is necessary to retain the deep-rooted male advantage in the world of politics is to do nothing about it and remain in a state of gender blind bliss. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Borge. I think the message comes through very clearly that we need to take action to hear women's voices more loudly in politics. Before I conclude this session, because we're running out of time, I would like to give two of the individuals on our panel the opportunity to respond to some of the statements made by Ms. Borge. Mr. Martin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Listen, I enjoyed very much Dr. Tabeed Borge's presentation. When it came to the European part, I did feel you wobbled a little bit. I think the question of the bendy cucumbers and bananas is a bit over the top, because we know that there's another case there, which is not. And you are wanting a European solution. There is a European solution which is already out there. I'm very sorry about the Maltese case, that you are actually the back marker in MEPs. You are at zero in terms of women representing Malta in the Strasbourg Assembly. But if I take the case of Finland, which you didn't quote, and I think you've been guilty of selective quoting a little bit on your European case. 62% of MEPs are women. Sweden, 56% of MEPs are women. If I go to Estonia, 50% of MEPs are women. If I go to Denmark, 46% are women. So I think you might have a Maltese challenge here, that you see things darker than they are in terms of what the situation is for women in Europe. Some women in Europe have got organized politically, have used their rights, and have used their rights at the elections. And I think that is very, very encouraging. So I would not advocate directives, I would not advocate regulations. I would just draw your attention to the actual Treaty of Rome back in 1957, where it was very clear that gender equality was there, because we were advocating equal pay, and that has been a theme which has always been within the European Union. What has happened is that national politics and national business has not pursued that aim sufficiently. But I am with you. I am with you. I do think women have got to do better, and we have to find a solution. As I said to you earlier, I did work for Commissioner Malmström, and she was very, very clear at one stage. She said in Sweden, when I wanted to get my way, she threatened to set up a women's party. And suddenly, the Social Democrats said, oh, gosh, no, the Women's Party will lose some of our electoral constituency. And she managed to move the party to a more feminist agenda. So I think it's up to the feminine skills to find their way forward out of this very complex web. But yes, certainly Europe can help. We've set up a equality institute, gender equality institute in Vilnius, and that's new. And we're pushing for it, but it needs also to come from the women themselves. I think it's a partnership rather than a top-down solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stern, please.
Just two things, really. In defense of the European Union, I think it's important just to note, I didn't have much time to talk about the UN agenda, what's been happening at the UN, but I would say that the European Union has actually been very important in pushing the rights agenda at the United Nations and often keeping that agenda going at times when it's been under attack from neoconservative and conservative forces in other quarters. So that would be to defend the EU at the international level. I think they play a very important role. The second thing I would say, though, related to Joanne's presentation, I think one of the things Joanne was talking about entrepreneurship in relation to business, but I think within the mainstreaming, gender mainstreaming literature, there is a notion of entrepreneurship within politics, gender entrepreneurship in politics. And I think it's very important that once women get elected to politics, we recognise that it's not just a question of numerical representation. It's about what happens when we get there. And it's also not just about the responsibility of women to push the agenda. It's the responsibility of everybody to push that agenda, because equality is something that we should all be interested in, men and women. And one, just very briefly, one of the things that comes out of the kind of analysis of gender mainstream and various other initiatives is that quite often there is a lot of kind of hoo-ha about getting people elected and a lot of rhetoric around the achievements, but then when people are elected, they come up against other barriers to push policies. So I think it's also very important that we have events like this and interested people beyond the institutions who work to constantly keep these things on track. It's an ongoing process. We need that ongoing engagement.
Thank you, Dr. Steen. Yes, I'm just going to ask Dr. Drake, and then we will conclude with you.
Thank you very much, Anna, for that. 2 points from my end. First of all, regarding facts, I think I would revise a little bit your slides on the cucumber, because I'm not even sure those directives are actually still in force. I mean, we are still living in the age of smart regulation, and there has been actually a regulation to remove those directives. So it's good, you know, that perhaps we stick more to more action and reason solutions rather than caricatures. I mean, I think that is one of the point I wanted to make. The second point is, of course, nothing is perfect, and of course, the European Union can, in theory, just have its own directive and regulation and say, okay, so much quotas for females in all the member states, etc., etc. I mean, of course, if the member states agree, by the way, don't forget that all rules and legislation have to be agreed by the member states. And I don't think in the age that we're living, it is very likely, in the age of subsidiarity, in the age of value added, even the budget debate in the European Union for the next financial perspectives up to 2020 is going to be ruled by what is of European value added. So I cannot imagine that in this age, it's false hopes if we're really hoping and looking up at the European Union to solve our problems. From my point of view, I agree very much with the line, it is a question of partnership. In an age where we are talking more and more about European value added, we're talking more and more about subsidiarity, when member states are more ready than ever to put up the flag, the banner of subsidiarity, smart regulation, it is less likely that we are going to have a future where the European Union is going to be making the rules and cutting out, you know, the pattern of the way of how we want to do things. Less and less. But we are looking at a European Union which is going to be the propeller and the platform for change. Why? Because it gives a platform for the visibility of good practices, which is already happening. I mean, we have been quoting, you know, the figures in Sweden and in Finland and all the other countries that have made progress. But the message is, it is a partnership. The European Union needs to propel us, needs to be there to give us the push, but at the end of the day, I think each country, in accordance with their own culture perhaps, at their own pace, needs to find their own solutions. But yes, let's be loud about the goal. Let's be loud about wanting to reach a certain goal by a certain time. But let's find the methods that what would work for us, being Malta, being Italy, being Spain, being wherever it is. The European Union will be there more and more to add value to national action, to add value to, and complement what's happening already on the ground. Let's not look at the EU to change everything that will maybe has formed us as Maltese. I am Maltese too. I have lived in Malta all my life, so I will never stop being Maltese, but I do feel passionately about this change that has to come, but I will not, as Commission, pose to have the solution of the way that the Maltese would like to do it in their own country. But let's use the European Union, yes, to keep pushing and propelling our leaders and our people, let's not forget the people, to think in a different way.
We'll just conclude very quickly. With
thank you. I think that was the whole idea of my presentation. I did use sort of examples which are a little bit far-fetched, but most of the regulation and most of the laws which today govern us are EU laws, and most of the changes, positive changes we've had, were thanks to EU directives. So I think the EU is in a position to continue pushing governments and to make a difference. When there is a directive, that is actually followed up, and you know, the EU does check that the country is complying. When you just have, I don't know, targets, like we had, for example, the Barcelona targets for childcare, a country can decide that it's not so important, and so the country will not do anything about it. And my message was, if you know, we can see an imbalance, if we can see something which is not working well, I think the EU should do a little bit more, and that was the message I wanted to put through.
National responses to European and global issues, the role of gender in international relations, was a symposium organized by the Department of International Relations and the European Commission representation in Malta. The symposium was organized on December 15, 2010 at Aula Magna in Valletta. This symposium will be broadcast in three parts on Campus FM. It will also be streamed on the Campus FM website.